Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome show, it's the show. God dang, I just realized how hot it is in here. I just realized that posting a photo of Ron Paul along with today's show notes might lead some to the mistaken impression that he's going to be a guest on the show today. Well, he ain't. I mean, I guess there's an open invite. But, yeah, no. I just think I can, I hope, I'm trying to trick Facebook into letting some of the 5,000 people who voluntarily signed up to see what I post, see what I post. I thought maybe if I made it a picture of Ron Paul, it would show it to them. For some reason, that seems to work a little bit better than just putting a link there. Tried to tag some stranger in the dang thing. I don't know how that works. Somebody, something or other. Anyway, it's the show. ACLU lady is going to be here today to talk about the state government's locking people in prison for nonviolent crimes. Ridiculously nonviolent crimes. And some of them actual crimes, many of them simple offenses against the wishes of those with state power. That's not the same thing, you see. A crime and an offense. Well, there are many people doing life without parole for nothing. And so the ACLU, they're trying to do something about it, starting with this giant report that they've written up about life without parole. So Jennifer Turner is her name. She's one of the lawyers. She'll be on the show today. I don't know what the hell happened to Matthew Akins. I hope nothing. Now that I say it that way, he's a reporter based in Kabul, Afghanistan. I was just thinking, well, geez, I hope, you know, his phone didn't get cut off, but geez, I hope especially nothing worse than that happened, too. Matthew Akins, he's the author of this piece on the A-Team killings in Afghanistan. Last spring, the remains of 10 missing Afghan villagers were dug up outside a U.S. Special Forces base. Was it a war crime or just another episode in a very dirty war? I think probably both. Well, I was supposed to record an interview with him a couple hours ago to play for you an hour from now. But whatever happened to that, I just couldn't tell you. But, you know, there's such a thing as time zone difficulties when you're dealing with reporters based in Afghanistan, I've come to find out. So, it's all right. We'll catch up with Matthew Akins. By the way, very well done piece. I hope that you'll take a look at it. Took him months to write, to investigate, and put together. A very well done piece. The 18 killings. I guess that's your current issue of Rolling Stone on the stands right now, or it's all right there at rollingstone.com. You can read the whole thing. You don't need a login or anything. And they're not just showing a splash page. They've got the whole article there for you. Very important work. Hell of a thing, man. You should read it. All right. And then Michael Osterlink will be on the show. Boy, I haven't talked with Michael in a long time. But he's one of these left-right realignment types. His issue primarily is military spending. He's got one called A Military for the 21st Century. At the American Conservative magazine. It's an interview. But I wanted to ask him also about this piece, which is actually by Denny Mertz from the Columb Foundation. And, well, they're all working together on this project to cut military spending. And anywhere that there actually are cuts in military spending, they're working to keep them. And boy, is that not an easy job. But they're getting the work done over there, and Michael Osterling will be back on the show to talk about it today. I was thinking when I was reading this thing, actually, of George Carlin's bit where he talks about, I can't remember how he leads into it. He's kind of changing subjects, and he's going, well, why do people put up with this? Jobs. People put up with anything for jobs. People clamor to live right next to a military base. I'll take me a little nuclear radiation if I can get me a job. And he says, you know, people are so screwed over. These are the kinds of decisions that they're left to make. They're choices that they have to choose from, kind of a thing. And, of course, he's right. And the saddest part of that, of course, is that we would all have so many more jobs if it wasn't for all the military bases. And I know that seems a little bit counterintuitive because there's always a hue and a cry whenever they close down a military base. Well, you're going to kill this little town. This little town that's built up around the military base. And what's supposed to happen to all the people who live in that town now? All the civilians who are maybe not even cashing in, but just taking part in the new local military economy there. Well, something. But what's going on there is lamenting the loss of the scene. Diner closed down. Cook, waitress, diner owner, all of them out of work now. Ouch. Should have kept that military base open. Would have kept the diner open. But you see the flaw, right? The unseen is where all that money could have gone in the first place instead of to the military. The military, as we're going to discuss with Michael Osterling, they're probably the least efficient distributors of resources in the history of all of mankind. Maybe even worse than the Soviet communists. Well, they have a lot more to work with in the first place than the communists did. But man, you talk about the economic proof that economic calculation cannot take place in a socialist system. The Pentagon is here to prove it for you. Just do nothing but waste. And so all those people at the diner could be doing something else. They could have already been doing something else and making more money. I mean, even if all the capital from a certain part of the country or whatever percentage from all of the country goes to create brand new factories for new weapons systems, that's still all just wealth destroyed. That's wealth put to use, digging up more wealth out of the ground and then assembling it with education that cost a bunch of wealth to, you know, be achieved and all the training and whatever. And then it's assembled into a weapon of destruction that will soon enough be scrapped itself if it doesn't, you know, get blown up in the war. And it's all waste. Oh, and of course, you know, they're destroying things that also were worth money before they were destroyed. So it's sort of like I was trying to set up, and yeah, he did a good job. I asked Bob Murphy about this yesterday. What if I was magic and I abolished all American militarism and the entire domestic homeland security national police state thing too, the security state, all of it, just gone. And we were to save all of that money, but at the same time, we would be firing all of those people. What a huge disruption that would be when you think about all the people who are employed at all the different contractors making things for the military and providing services for the military around the country and around the world. Huge dislocation. And Bob Murphy says, oh, yeah, no, don't worry about it, because then all that wealth can be appropriated to productive uses instead of destructive ones. And all those people can all go get other, better jobs, creating things that will benefit other people instead of just high explosive delivery vehicles all the time. And so, don't worry. It's true. If you close Fort Hood, Killeen will cease to exist. But who cares? Who wants to live in Killeen anyway, unless you have a real good job making money providing services for the military? You know, funeral homes, psychiatrists, motorcycle salesmen. So, it's all right. Close down Fort Hood. Close down Killeen. Let market forces decide how much property in Killeen is really worth. And, you know, we'll keep it for a place to, I don't know, drive by on the way to somewhere else. I guess I was going to say, you know, stop and pee on the way to Dallas, but it's really kind of a little bit off I-35. Anyway, people are really scared of that. People are really scared of losing jobs. Robert Gates, George Bush's Secretary of Defense, said, we don't need the F-22. The F-22 was designed in the late 80s to fight the Soviet Union, whatever jet they would have by now. But there is no Soviet Union. And whatever jet the Russians have by now, we can fight with our F-18s and 16s and 15s, and we don't have 14s anymore. I think they threw all those in the water. With our A-10 Warthogs. Ain't afraid of the Russians. Don't need an F-22 to fight the Russians. And you can't kill villagers on the ground with an F-22. It's an air-to-air combat kind of a plane. Well, what a waste. What we'll do is, we'll scrap those and we'll focus on creating F-35s, because at least you can kill villagers fighting for their independence from the red-coated American occupiers imperializing their land. Except F-35 is the world's worst piece of crap ever. And you could buy however many dozens and dozens and dozens of F-16s for the price of one of them. The whole thing is just a giant rape of the American taxpayer. Oh, but in the computer simulation, it can take off vertically. Oh, really? Yeah, except that's completely useless. For example, for the Marines, where they would need such an elaborate base on the beach to service an F-35 that any beach landing that they're doing is past the need for support from a fighter jet at that point anyway. If they've been able to build up such a base, you could park F-35s at it. The whole thing is ridiculous. And so anyway, but the point is, the people protested. The people of the congressional districts where the F-22s were being put together. And they said, we don't care if the F-22 is a piece of crap. And we don't care if the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs have all agreed that they don't need it. We want to keep making it. And so that was it. They relented. They keep making the F-22s anyway. The plane nobody even wants. And they keep making the F-35s too, which some of them want, but is still no good for nothing. And in fact, I believe it was our old friend, was it Elaine Barrier? Oh boy, sometimes I have trouble keeping track of all these journalists. I think it was. Who pointed out that, you know, the F-35 isn't even any good for killing Afghans or Pakistanis or Nigerians or, you know, other basically defenseless villagers in the countries where America is occupying and killing people because they're too fast. I mean, if you really want air support, air-to-ground weaponry, the A-10 is fine. The A-10 gets the job done. It's slow enough, you can target a tank with it and actually kill the damn thing. Instead of, you know, shooting your missile from 100 miles away and then finding out when you get back to base whether it was worth it to go all that way to fire off one missile. You don't even know whether it hit yet. I guess maybe that's a thing of the past, you find out on the spot. But still, the point being, F-35s aren't good for a ground attack. F-35s aren't good for nothing other than holding down a taxpayer and raping him and stealing his wallet. Oh, got an F-35 we got to build with this. So you see why you don't mind so much what just happened to you. And just think, you know, somebody is going to be able to kill somebody with this thing someday. And doesn't that make you feel good? Doesn't that make you feel a little bit powerful? That you're helping the government to kill somebody? In fact, I got a Danny Kaye song like that, where he's singing about how happy he is that he paid his income tax, because you see that bomber up in the sky? Rockefeller built that thing, but so did I. Do you know the song? It's a classic. What? It's not my fault that iTunes is the worst program ever designed. Well, they're on version 14 now, and they just keep adding and adding and adding onto the code, I guess. No point in rewriting the damn thing from scratch with what you learned up through the end of 2013. No, it should take a good 45 seconds to open iTunes, don't you think? You know, if I worked at Apple and I was the head of the iTunes Software Development Laboratory, I would say, hey, this program better open within, say, I don't know, 45 seconds, or else we're going to have a real problem, guys. You know, because that would just not be cool at all.
I said to my Uncle Sam, old man taxes, here I am, and he was glad to see me. Mr. Small Fry, yes indeed, lower brackets, that's my speed, but he was glad to see me. I paid my income tax today. I never felt so proud before to be right there with the millions more who pay their income tax today. I'm squared up with the USA. You see those bombers in the sky? Rockefeller helped to build them, so did I. I paid my income tax today. I paid my income tax today. 1,000 planes to bomb Berlin, they'll all be paid for and I chipped in. That certainly makes me feel okay. 10,000 more and that ain't hay. We must pay for this war somehow. Uncle Sam was worried, but he isn't now. I paid my income tax today.
Don't you feel patriotic now? Don't you want to go tear the human lives of some Afghans apart with some superheated shrapnel? Oh, it's fun to hear them scream. Oh, I mean, it's fun to know that somebody's killing them out there somewhere and not have to hear them scream, right? That's the fun part. Well, you know, F-35s are expensive, Scott Horton, but I like knowing that Muslims are being killed. What can I say? Say the Americans. Well, you know, Rand Paul says that Islam is an offensive threat to the United States, and anything our military does to kill Muslims is simply a defense against their radical jihad. So that's what the Israelis say. There are no innocents among our enemies, even the babies, right? That's the policy. And besides, jobs. Jobs. More awesome radio like this coming up next. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, how's it going? Ah, geez, I meant to change the music from Monday's music to Tuesday's, but I forgot. Oh, well. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like I say, Michael Osterlink will be on the show a little bit later on, and so will Jennifer Turner from the ACLU. And, I got a little bit of news to cover here. Boy, I spent too much time talking about the fighter plane ripoff and all that. Although, here, let me say a couple more things about it, in case this doesn't have a chance to come up during the interview, although I think it will. Special report from Reuters by Scott J. Paltrow. Special report, the Pentagon's doctored ledgers conceal epic waste. Trillions of dollars. Trillions. And the article, I haven't even gotten through like a fifth of it or something. It's a real piece of work here at Reuters.com. But just at the beginning of it, it's about how, oh, they would just make up the numbers to quote-unquote balance the account every month. And they would never have complete data. They would never have balanced anything. They would never even really be able to cite under which appropriation they supposedly were authorized to even spend this money. And so every month, and this is, they start out with the Navy lady. Every month, when it came to making up numbers day, they just sit there and make up numbers. And they're off now. Just this Navy office, they say, is off by a trillion. Right? Where's that? Anyway, I'm going to have this whole thing read, and I'm going to try to get this guy on the show to talk about this. But we are talking about, where did I see the trillion number from the right off the bat there? I think it was the link where I followed to this, actually. Well, anyway, bazillions of dollars. Billions and billions and billions and billions. Tens, hundreds of billions, at least, of dollars unaccounted for. You might be familiar with, this was Donald Rumsfeld's thing about, you know, wanting to transform the military to do it his way and all that, was he brought up that they had misplaced approximately $3 trillion just in, I guess, the 1990s, right? Just in the Bush senior and Clinton years. And, where does all that money go? Who gets it? I mean, I know that a lot of these officers retire in comfort, but I wonder if they even get it all. Does it just get funneled right back into the corporate heads and the very top-level generals? Or is it humanly possible, if you could freeze time like Bewitched and hire the world's greatest mathematicians, could they actually just go in there and sort it all out? Who paid who what? and how much they're off, is it even conceivable in this universe for someone to untangle? How much money is missing? Where might it have actually ended up? Anyway, this thing is huge. Please go look at it. Special report at Reuters. The Pentagon's doctored ledgers conceal epic waste. I've had a lot of trouble getting Reuters reporters on. I think they kind of had a rule about doing radio or something there. I don't know. I should try again. It's been way too long since I tried, but this is really worth looking at. I wanted to mention Andrew Coburn brought up Bruce Jackson from Lockheed on the show the other day when I was talking with him. And there's this great article. You can find it at Corp Watch. It's also at Playboy.com, or at least it used to be. But you can find the whole thing at Corp Watch. And I think one other place has it reprinted, too. It's called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's by Richard Cummings. And it's really good. And it tells the whole story in there about how Lockheed gave up on competing in the market whatsoever. They developed this plane that was supposed to compete with the DC-10 or whatever. I forget what it was called. But nobody wanted it. Delta, American, United, Pan Am, this is back in the 70s, said, nah, no thanks, we don't like this plane. We're going to go with the competition instead, I guess, which would have been Boeing. And Lockheed said, well, screw this. We're just not going to try to compete in a free market anymore. We're going to go buy up the Pentagon. And then we're going to sell exclusively to the Pentagon. And then they figured out really quickly that, you know, it would be helpful if we knew what kind of weapons to make for the Pentagon. You know, it would be a good way to figure that out. We'll just create the foreign policy. And then we'll tailor the foreign policy to meet our weapon sales needs. And that sounds like it couldn't possibly be true, maybe, unless you're a commie or something and you're just naturally hell-bent that way. Or maybe if you're a libertarian and you really understand the economics of the war, but I don't know. I think just not even a conservative, but just a plain old regular American would assume that there's got to be some kind of check, balance, safeguard to prevent something like that from happening. But no. This is the cause of NATO expansion all the way up to Russia's door. In violation, as Andrew Coburn said, in violation of the solemn promise of George Bush and James Baker at the end of the Cold War. Go ahead and dissolve USSR, and we promise you Russians we will not expand NATO. Well, Lockheed had other needs, like selling jet fighters to the Americans to give as welfare to Eastern European politicians. And so it was done. And then they did the same thing with Iraq, too. The whole shock and awe thing was just a Lockheed video, a promotional video. Every kind of missile, every kind of plane, every kind of everything. Every battery pack, every whatever. Not that it all worked, but just that it was all part of the... It was like the war itself, almost, was the kind of crap you would see in a promotional video. In the wars of the future, we'll be able to just kick Saddam Hussein's ass by using these 75 different Lockheed products all in conjunction together. You believe that, right, General? Sign here. Doesn't make it real, but it does make it the policy. And that thing will blow your mind if you haven't read it. Read it. Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's a little bit out of date, but you know what? All your friends are in there. All the neoconservatives. All of your favorite household name neocons are in there. Working for Lockheed one way or the other. So as long as we're talking about, you know, the economics of corrupt American militarism, gotta mention Richard Cummings and Bruce Jackson and Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. All right, and then there's brand new FISA stuff out, and it's not Snowden documents. It's Freedom of Information Act stuff, and I'll send you over to The Guardian to read. Spencer Ackerman has a... pretty long piece, a couple thousand words on it there, about apparently the original FISA judge saying, man, I don't know, guys, but okay, in authorizing the metadata blanket surveillance. So that's definitely worth taking a look at. And then, oh yeah, because I have a no-show interview, I'll have a whole other half hour to tell you things too. Isn't that nice? Hang tight. Jennifer Turner from the ACLU coming up next. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org, libertyexpressradio.com.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's Scott Horton's show. And our first guest on the show today is Jennifer Turner. She's the human rights researcher... in the American Civil Liberties Union Human Rights Program. And, boy, they got this new thing out that if you got a heart, it's going to break it. It's the Life Without Parole report. More than 3,200 serving life without parole for nonviolent offenses. And it's A Living Death is the title. Living Death, Life Without Parole for Nonviolent Offenses. Welcome back to the show, Jennifer. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on the show. And, boy, pretty upset about reading this thing. First and foremost, can you explain a little bit about why you even write in this thing that these numbers are far too low, that you can't account for all the people who are really in prison for life without parole, for violent and nonviolent
crimes?
Yeah,
that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. We found that 3,278 people are definitely serving life without the possibility of parole for nonviolent crimes. But that really underestimates the number of people who will die in prison for nonviolent crimes that they committed. These numbers are just people who are serving formal sentences that are life without parole. It doesn't account for people who get sentences like 350 years for drug sales, for instance, or people who get life sentences who don't really get any kind of meaningful consideration for parole. And in California, for instance, there are many, many prisoners serving life sentences for nonviolent crimes who are eligible for parole, but the parole board has denied 98% of the parole requests it's heard and really doesn't consider them adequately.
Wow. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. I guess it would take a whole other study to try to account for all that. I guess, you know, just judging from, you know, accidental kind of, you know, anecdotal knowledge from TV and that kind of thing I've picked up over the years, I get the idea that people are sentenced to those kind of 300 and 400 years type of sentences quite often. That maybe some states, they don't have a life without parole option, but they'll just go ahead and find you guilty on so many counts that they stack your years up so high that you'll die of old age in there anyway.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, for instance, Alaska doesn't have life without parole as an available sentence under its laws, but it doles out sentences of 99 years quite regularly. People frequently are sentenced to 40 years, 50 years, 60 years for, say, nonviolent drug crimes, like including just drug possession. And given their age, it's pretty much impossible that they would be released from prison during their lifetime.
Right. Now, when it comes to life without parole here in Texas, for a long time, I believe pretty much the only debate about it was if we have an option of life without parole, then people won't be sentenced to death as often, and that would be problematic. And so we don't want to have life without parole as an option. And it was really anti-death penalty forces, I believe, who finally fought for and won a life without parole option. Because he ended up having people sentenced to death who really shouldn't have been, but the jurors still wanted them to be locked up and stay there, but maybe not have them executed, was the thinking.
Right. Well, and, you know, the reality is, you know, you would expect a sentence like life without parole, which is the most severe sentence short of the death penalty in this country. You would expect it to be reserved for those who've committed the most heinous crimes. But in reality, what's happening around the country is that people are being sentenced to life without parole for crimes as petty as siphoning gasoline out of a truck, for shoplifting 3 belts from a store, for shoplifting a laptop computer from Walmart, for having a bottle cap smeared with a smidge of heroin residue that's so minute it can't be weighed, for being the middleman in a sale of $10 in marijuana. I mean, I can list case after case after case where clearly the punishment does not fit the crime.
Well, please do. In fact, slow down a little bit and elaborate on those. So somebody has, you know, I don't know, the lab says that there's a smear of heroin on a bottle cap. And how in the world does that end up equaling a life sentence without parole? Don't all of those drug charges have to have a weight involved?
Well, it turns out no. I found 2 cases where people were sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for an amount of drugs that was not weighable. So in the case that you're meant that we're talking about, the bottle cap case, is a man named Paul Carter in Louisiana who's standing on a street corner. And undercover cops approached him and asked to search his pockets. He was a heroin addict, according to himself, and they found a bottle cap in his pocket, which had just a smear of heroin residue. They sent it to the labs and found that it couldn't be weighed, but they said it counted as possession of heroin. And because of prior convictions, one for escape at 18 and one for possession of stolen property when he was 21, he was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole under, in that case, Louisiana's 3 strikes laws. He's been incarcerated now for 16 years. And you know, he's done substance abuse treatment in prison. He's remained clean. And it's really both a waste of his life, but also a waste of taxpayer dollars to keep him incarcerated for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Well, I try not to get too far into that because, you know, maybe just taking them out back and shooting them would be cheapest, but I don't want to encourage that. You know, if the most just result costs the most, then that's fine with me too, right? What matters here is their human lives, which are priceless. And the thought, I mean, for anyone, put yourself in this position where somebody, you say a middleman, somebody goes, oh yeah, I know a guy who could probably sell you 10 bucks worth of weed. Life in prison for that? Imagine me locked up like an animal for the rest of your life in a cage. And with other people who presumably, at least some of them, are guilty of violent crimes and deserve to be there. You know what I mean? And who might actually be dangerous to be locked up with. I mean, that's no picnic going to the pen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's amazing to think that, well, anyway, the cost thing, that I don't want to focus on that is all I was trying to say.
Yeah,
but,
how many
states have these 3 strikes and you're out laws? And don't they know, the legislators who come up with that, they know as well as the judges that this is going to end up leading to a lot of unfair circumstances and destroy families.
Every state around the country has some form of a 3 strikes law, including the federal system. But
I did not
only
know that
nine
at all.
States. Yeah, but only 9 states in the country have people serving life without parole for nonviolent crime, at least according to the statistics, the data we got from the State Departments of Corrections around the country. Now, there will maybe more states. So, in fact, we just found out that Michigan has at least one person serving life without parole for marijuana, even though their state prison system told us no one is serving life without parole for nonviolent crime. So it's at least 9 states. And in people who are serving life without parole in those states are largely been sentenced under 3 strikes or other habitual offender laws, but not exclusively. Some states also very heavily punish drug crimes especially, but also property crimes with mandatory sentences that can be life without parole.
Yeah. Well, and okay, so now out of the 3,278, you say 79%, that's the 3,278 people locked up that you guys studied. 79% of them were there on nonviolent drug charges, but what percentage of them were there on nonviolent charges one way or the other? Like you talk about shoplifting and burglary and things like that.
Well, so 79% are there for drug charges, and the rest are pretty much there for property crimes. So the property crimes are crimes like possession of stolen property, shoplifting, theft, burglary. We didn't count crimes like robbery, for instance, because we categorize that as a violent crime, since the definition of robbery is use or threat of force to get something. So we were only looking at cases where there's no interpersonal violence. So somebody who broke into someone's home, broke into an office building, many cases of possession of stolen property, including one guy who got life without parole for possession of stolen junk metal. He was a junk dealer who bought a few valves and an elbow pipe from one junk dealer and sold it to another, which is what junk dealers do. But it was found that the scrap metal had been stolen, and he got life without parole for that.
Wow. Yeah, where they didn't even have to prove it. Doesn't sound like that he knew it was stolen and bought from another dealer.
Yeah, he wasn't even accused of having stolen. These are possession of stolen property cases where there were no allegations that the person even was involved in the original theft of the goods. But they were found with them later.
Right. Okay. Now, so I'm sorry, because I guess I misunderstood the statistics there. The 3270, the 3278. It's 2,589 or so of those are drug charges, the rest burglaries and shoplifting and such. But then, so what percentage is that out of all the people doing life without parole?
The violent
versus the nonviolent.
Yeah, so the overall number of people serving life without parole is much higher. I'm just trying to remember exactly what the number is, but significantly higher than that. The percentage, I mean, it's one part of the population. I should say, you know, we're talking about people serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes. You know, they're just a part of it, like a much bigger problem. And I think these cases are really the most extreme manifestation of our sentencing laws in this country, which have truly gotten out of control. I mean, extreme sentencing across the board for different types of crimes, not just nonviolent crimes and not just life without parole. But these cases really, I think, show how unfair our sentencing laws have become.
Well, sure. I mean, you talk about, you know, somebody gets life without parole because they got in a bar fight or something like that. That might count as violent, but it's hardly the kind of thing that someone should be sentenced like that for. But now, can you give us a ballpark as far as, 20, 30, 70% or what percentage it is of people doing life without parole are in there for one kind of nonviolent crime or another?
Well, the number of people doing life without parole for a nonviolent crime it's 3,278, and the total number of people serving life sentences of any kind are 159,500. Okay. Now, the number of those who are doing it without parole are almost 50,000, 49,000 people. So
this is, well, I'm way bad at math, but something on the order of almost 10% of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. And then, again, not that says that anybody who's in there for
15%.
Something violent automatically deserves it, but just we're talking about a smaller subset here.
Exactly, yeah. And really what we're saying is, I mean, what these sentences show is how ineffective and how extreme our sentencing has become across the board in this country. I mean, what does it say about us as a country if we would sentence someone to life without the possibility of parole for siphoning gas out of a truck? And what does it say about how we sentence people for any crime in this country?
I think more than anything, it says that people are way too susceptible to the television, because none of this has to do necessarily with, and you guys are the world's experts on this, if you go and overlay this and that graph of sentencing and punishment and harshness, it has a lot more to do with media coverage of crime than it has to do with the actual crime rate. And I remember back in the so-called crack epidemic of the 1980s, when Tom Brokaw was doing a special every couple of weeks about the Crips and the Bloods, oh, feral young black men with machine guns are coming to your neighborhood with their blue do-rags. And people were scared to death, but it wasn't true. It was so blown out of proportion. It was completely ridiculous. But the polls showed that the people's fear of it wasn't related to the real numbers of the crimes. It was related to the amount of coverage on TV that the crimes got.
Well, yeah, and, you know, these sentences and the prevalence of life without parole sentences for nonviolent crimes is really a symptom of the more than four decades of the war on drugs and tough on crime policies, many of which were passed, as you said, especially in the 80s and early 90s, because of a public concern about crime rates because of highly publicized murders, or just a handful of publicized murders, the death of one athletic star from a drug overdose. And that really helped fuel the passage of laws that I think no one really expected the consequences would be, that today we would be spending so much and throwing away the key for so many people's lives for nonviolent crimes. These laws very much can be traced back to that period. And what's interesting, as you mentioned, with crime rates, there's a number of people serving life without parole. Now, this is for both violent and nonviolent crime, has quadrupled in the last just 20 years. And throughout those 20 years, crime rates have been dropping. So there isn't even a correlation. I mean, the number of people incarcerated is now over 2.3 million in this country. And even though the crime rates have been dropping consistently for at least the past 20 years, if not longer.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the typical talk radio talking point there is, well, that's right, because we locked up all the bad guys and now we're safe or something. But the numbers don't bear that out, do they?
Well, no, they don't, because if you overlay a map of the number of people incarcerated, what you'll see is that it stayed very consistent from 1930 through 1970, and then it shot up. And then if you overlay that with the crime rate, you'll see that the crime rate has been consistently dropping now for over two decades, even as the incarceration rate was shooting up very high. And it wasn't a direct correlation of, look, crime was going up, then we start incarcerating people, and then crime went down. Rather, we're incarcerating more and more and more and more people, even though crime rates have been consistently dropping.
Right.
So it doesn't bear out. The link isn't there. What we know is that people are incarcerated because our laws have become much more extreme, because we've passed mandatory sentencing laws that don't give judges any kind of opportunity to judge and to choose a punishment that fits the crime. Instead, we're just locking people up reflexively with these one-size-fits-all policies that were passed a long time ago that I don't think that the public really intended this outcome.
Right. Well, now that this is what we've got, do you think the message is getting across? Because we are talking about a lot of people who don't deserve to be there, which means a lot of Americans who know somebody who doesn't deserve to be there and who is. You know, it seems like at some point maybe it'll be good politics for someone running for office to try to fix this.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're really at a historic moment now for possibilities for reform. The Attorney General himself in August said that we put far too many people in prison for far too long, and he announced some reforms of mandatory sentencing laws that don't really go far enough, but they're certainly a very, very important first step. And even the president himself has expressed concern about how we sentence people, particularly people who've committed nonviolent crimes. But beyond that, you know, federal judges have for many years been opposing mandatory sentences, and there have really been kind of a rallying cry from the bench saying we need to change these laws so judges can do their job and judge in individual cases. But more recently, particularly in states that are dealing with depleted state coffers, they're dealing with the fact that they're spending more to incarcerate than they are to educate the public in the states, are calling for some reforms. And some reform-minded governors have instituted some reforms. But there's finally this moment where I think there is some growing consensus across both sides of the political aisle that there's a need for reform. And this is the moment, I think, for the public to support those reforms. And we have a petition on our website, aclu.org/livingdeath. If you can click take action, you can sign a petition to President Obama to review the sentences of the prisoners in federal prisoners serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes. But also in the states and the federal government, it's really time to pass laws that would end life without parole sentences for nonviolent crimes. And there are two bipartisan bills in front of Congress now that would somewhat limit the reach of mandatory minimum sentencing laws that would also help to make our sentencing system more fair and smarter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sure wish you luck with that. I know that Senator James Webb tried to do some reforms, and then he just quit in disgust because he couldn't get anywhere, right?
Well, I don't know much about that, but I know that there have been some senators who've been leading the charge. I mean, Rand Paul recently has made very strong statements about the need to reform mandatory minimum sentencing laws, particularly. Mm-hmm. And there are, especially, I think, among conservatives, there have been more and more, I think, spoken about the need for certain reforms, and I just hope that it will result in some real change. But I think that these lawmakers, the ones who do think it's time to change our sentencing system to one that's smarter and fairer, really need the support of the public behind them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I think that it would be great politics if the ACLU would adopt a pro-Second Amendment position. Because as I was reading through this, I saw where at least a few of these people doing life without parole are doing life without parole for having a gun on them, not for doing anything with it. And I think that, you know, typical card-carrying ACLU supporters like to imagine that if we pass a bunch of gun laws, it's going to take guns away from, well, I don't know who they think is going to do something bad next. But what it ends up being is a lot of poor, powerless, minority group type people end up being victims of the DA's office and end up doing huge prison terms for nothing, just for owning an object. And that's, is, you know, when we look at these kind of sentences and we say, you know, this is what's wrong with the war on drugs, we need to roll back the war on drugs, we ought to be saying, let's roll back the war on guns, too, because that's a big part of this whole thing. And
it's
then you get every right-wing group will go, wow, the ACLU found the Second Amendment. Now they like the whole Bill of Rights. All right. And then all that bad blood will be washed away and we'll have a whole new coalition of the whole Bill of Rights.
You know, it's true that in some of the cases I documented, people were sentenced to life without parole purely for possession of a weapon. So in these cases, it was for the crime of being a felon, a convicted felon in possession of a weapon. So there were no allegations that they used the weapon or that they committed any crimes with the weapon. It was just that because they had a criminal record, a felon record, that they weren't lawfully allowed to have a weapon. And in some states, they were sentenced to life without parole for that crime.
Yeah, I mean, and now how many rich white guys were sentenced to life without parole for holding a gun in their hand?
Well, I didn't find any such cases, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
For the most part, really, in the cases I documented, at least...
Not that would be okay, but of course we know who the victims are here. It's the brown and the powerless.
Yeah, in the cases I document, at least the vast majority were from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Many had dropped out of school, were not, you know, hadn't completed high school. But what was also most shocking about my findings was that there's staggering racial disparity in sentencing people to life without parole for nonviolent crimes. So we know that there's racial disparity in the criminal justice system, but we found that 65% of the people serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes are black, and 18% are white. And that is, those differences are much more striking than among just the general prison and jail population, which suggests that there is unequal treatment of blacks by the criminal justice system. And in the federal system, blacks are 20 times more likely than whites to be sentenced to life without parole for nonviolent crimes. Latinos are 5 times more likely to be sentenced to die in prison for nonviolent crime than whites. And in the states, it varies. In some, it's worse than others. In Louisiana, over 91% of the prisoners serving life without parole for nonviolent crime are black, and they're 23 times more likely to be sentenced to die in prison for a nonviolent crime than whites.
Wow, that is amazing. What's the solution to that other than just the wholesale repeal of the drug war, you know, that we talked about? Is there anything that can be done to, well, of course, what will happen is they'll just crack down on more white people and try to balance it out rather than lay off of, you know, poor black folks.
Well, you know, eliminating nonviolent crimes is a strike in the 3-strike laws of the states, and eliminating life without parole sentences for drugs specifically, is where, which is where we see the greatest disparities, would effectively reverse these racial disparities.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And it's a good place to start, where it's not like me asking for the whole loaf all at once and everything. You get to actually be reasonable and get some work done. Now, so one of the things that you write about in here, too, that's very important is about how the judges, and we hear this a lot, right, where the judge says, I'm so sorry to have to do this to you, but it's my job. 50 years or whatever, right? The mandatory minimums. It seems like they could all just resign and get real jobs. But anyway, they carry on, but who really has the discretion is the prosecutors. And the prosecutors decide with a stroke of a pen whether they want to charge this or charge that. And they know that if they charge that, it's going to be life without parole. And in a sense, they're the ones doing the sentencing on some of these slam dunk drug possession cases and so forth. And I don't know. Does that seem right to you? That it really works out where they sort of are the judge, right? The prosecutor.
That's exactly the problem, is that these laws, I mean, discretion's been shifted to the prosecutors. Mandatory sentencing laws have shifted all the discretion to the prosecutors. So the prosecutor decides how the crime's going to be charged. The prosecutor decides what the sentence will be. And in, as you said, in many of the cases I reviewed, the judges objected to the sentence, but their hands were tied. One judge, when he was sentencing a man to life in prison without parole for selling small amounts of crack at a time over the course of a couple of weeks out of a rundown hotel room to support his drug addiction, he said, "This is a travesty. It's just silly, but my hands are tied." And a big part of the problem is that the law casts a really wide net, so it subjects defendants to these extreme sentences that lawmakers simply never intended. Legislatures just didn't anticipate that these crimes would be these sentences would be imposed on people for such minor crimes.
Right.
But now the prosecutors hold most of the power. They have a responsibility to wield it fairly, and unfortunately, in many of these cases, they're simply not. I mean, I even documented cases where the judge refused to impose the mandatory sentence. One guy, the judge refused to impose any sentence. He had threatened a cop while handcuffed in the back of a police cruiser, but the prosecutor continued to appeal. I saw cases where the prosecutor appealed 2-3 times, where the sentence kept going up incrementally. The judge said, "Okay, fine, I'll give you 10 years, make it 20 years, make it 30 years, but they were forced to impose life without parole under the law.
Amazing. Well, you know, I've told this story over and over again, and I'll keep telling it. I may have told it to you. Sorry if I did, but I used to be a cab driver, and I met an assistant DA from Houston, which I think is in second place behind America, or maybe third place behind America and China for most executions in the world. And she said that the motto at the Houston District Attorney's Office is, or Harris County District Attorney's Office is, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. Which means that anyone the cops bring them gets nailed to the wall for as much as they could possibly do to them. And they don't care at all that these are human beings and that they have a natural born right to their life. And they don't care whether they did it or not. They don't even try to know whether they did it or not. And of course, they're wrong that if they're really innocent, they'll get out on appeal, because the appeal, correct me if I'm wrong, is only a question of whether the judicial process was fair or not, and the burden is on the the convict to prove that something was wrong with the trial in the process, rather than, "I really ain't the guy you were looking for." That's not even the question in an appeal.
Well, it's, you know, the cases I looked at, the people who've been sentenced, who are serving these sentences till they die in prison for nonviolent crimes, had a lot of challenges in fighting their cases. So many of them could not afford private attorneys, so they had court-appointed attorneys, many of whom are overworked, and some of whom are just not doing their job. I mean, I talked to people where their attorney did not put on really any defense, called no witnesses, didn't subpoena the witnesses in the case, barely made any argument at trial, and the trial lasted less than a day in some of these cases. And it made it nearly impossible for these people to make any kind of legal claims, to really assert their innocence adequately. And what's more, once they have been convicted, they don't have a right to a court-appointed attorney for post-conviction appeals. So you can have, you know, you have a court-appointed attorney for the trial, but if you can't afford a lawyer to represent you after you've been convicted, you don't have any choice but to represent yourself. So I've looked at a lot of cases where people were really on their own after their trial. Even if their lawyer did a terrible job, they were trying to make claims about ineffective assistance of counsel and couldn't go anywhere. And I looked at cases where they filed their appeals in pencil, handwritten, people who weren't even literate trying to make legal arguments.
All right, we got to go. I'm sorry, Jennifer. Thank you so much. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, sure.
We
got
to run. Jennifer Turner, everybody, from the ACLU. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
The study is Living Death, Life Without Parole at ACLU.org. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate.
And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016, FDR, no longer the worst president in American history, the National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952, and USA. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of
Rights? That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, you guys, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Crazy. I'm going to have to read about that later on. All right. So, yeah, I'm Scott. Yeah, it's my show where I complain about stuff and interview people. And, yeah, it's too bad about the hard breaks. I'm always so clumsy about the end of the show there. And I apologize to Jennifer Turner for that. But it's such great work. It's such important work that they do there. I hope all of you who can afford it are card-carrying members of the ACLU. And even if... you hate the ACLU. Man, you gotta love the ACLU, dude. Without them, America would suck so much worse. Are you kidding me? In so many ways. And especially on the mass imprisonment of the powerless here. It's so out of control. It's like we talk about with the torture thing. You know? America's had a lot of problems for a long, long time. But it used to be, at least, that... officially, we didn't torture people, right? Now, local city police tortured people all the time, and the CIA trained South American, mirror sunglasses types in their military juntas on how to torture people, within an inch of their life and beyond. But America, as a thing, well, we don't torture. We're not torturers. We're upholding enlightenment Western civilization here, man. And with the best part of the old world Christianity kind of thing, too, where Sermon on the Mount and the Eighth Amendment. And we just don't torture people because, yeah, Thomas Jefferson or something. But then it was announced that, oh, yeah, the Republicans have been torturing people. And most Americans who were Republicans said, well, good then, I guess, right, leaders? Okay, good. Minimize it, rationalize it, internalize it, adopt it. Become a society of pro-torturers. And TV's there to help you along. And so now, that whole thing where Americans at least could sort of kind of pretend... That was one sin our society was mostly innocent of, right? That's over now. Now, oh yeah, we're torturers in America. Yeah, that's how our government does business. Well, sometimes you gotta just beat it out of them. Ask Kiefer Sutherland, he'll tell you. You might have to beat it out of Kiefer Sutherland. But I bet if you tortured him bad enough, he would admit... And sometimes you gotta just torture it out of somebody or they won't talk.
And especially if you're trying to get them to say exactly the right thing that you want them to say. Like, Saddam taught you how to mix chemical weapons, right? Now, don't describe what he taught you to do, because it would obviously be made up and therefore wholly and completely laughable and inaccurate and impossible. So, but just say that, yeah, it was Saddam's guys trained you. Sometimes you just got to beat it out of him. Turn us into a society of torturers. Well, the same thing here. You know, it used to be, and this is before my lifetime now. Now I'm in with you millennials on this one. Back before my lifetime, there were minimal numbers of people in prison. Mostly hardened felons. I'm not saying that innocent, you know, the error rate and the impunity rate of innocent people who didn't deserve to be there at all wasn't there or whatever. But it's a very new, as she was saying, the gigantic percent just in the last generation. The incredible increase in prosecutions on mostly on drug war issues and the lengthening of sentences and all of this has, we now have a prison population of 2.3 million people. And then that's 7 million people if you count everybody who's in jail awaiting trial or doing, you know, shorter time on more minor offenses and crimes, and then also all the people on parole or probation paying monthly rent for their, you know, half liberty with an ankle bracelet and having to go to 15 classes and living death slavery anyway. 7 million. And that's not because Americans are such lousy people. You know, not any more than they ever were anyway. It's the government is out of control. That's what it is. And there's got to be a pushback. And she's right that, you know, when George H.W. Bush back in 1990 said, we got to stop the drug war and the terrible gangs and the violence and the crime, and we're going to do the crime. And people said, yeah, they didn't think that this is going to be, you know, like a army op. As far as the broadsword and the collateral damage involved. I thought, yay, heroic, wonderful police who love me more than I love my own self are going to love me and protect me and keep me safe and keep all the bad, bad, bad guys away. But, you know, we were joking about this during the surge in Afghanistan, how the Marines went to the LAPD, and this may have been actually in the first surge in Iraq in 07. They went to the LAPD and said, we forgot how to do counterinsurgency, but we have it written down on a piece of paper somewhere that we taught you how to do counterinsurgency back in the early 80s with our expertise that we had left over from Vietnam. They're real expert at pacifying the Vietnamese, you understand. And so the Marines said to the LAPD, can you teach us counterinsurgency doctrine again? And so, you know, that means sweeps of fighting age males, arrests of all of them, right? Which in those days meant a black man who's outside south of the 10 in LA. Oh, outside between the ages of, I don't know, 12 and 70. Grab him. The Marines taught us how to do counterinsurgency. And yeah, that's a, that's the smart way of fighting a war. Except they're supposed to be cops. They're supposed to be peace officers and all of that. It's not supposed to be a real war. That's supposed to just be a turn of phrase. They can shake you loose of your money. But, oh, look, now they drive tanks. They carry machine guns. They dress in as much body armor as army soldiers in Afghanistan right now. Probably more. And by the way, this is just kind of an aside, but these way overly militarized cops, don't they kind of feel silly? I mean, when I was a little kid, like, say, kindergarten through fourth grade, me and my friends, that's all we did was play guns, toy guns. And we would divide up into teams, and then we would pretend to kill each other. And it was great. And there was the woods, and we would go to the woods, and we would play guns. But then we quit that in fifth grade because all of a sudden we cared whether girls who were pretending to be mature adults thought of us or not. And so we had to stop. We had to put down our toys and, you know, find other interests. But every time I look at the pictures of these SWAT cops, where they're just wearing, they're wearing more body armor than anyone in history, right? No one, no soldier has ever gone to battle as heavily protected as a SWAT cop working for any county USA Sheriff's Department right now. And it just looks so ridiculous. I mean, you're right that we hate you, but we're not all as violent as you. That's what's going on there, right? The cops, I shouldn't directly address them, I'm afraid. The cops, they just project onto the rest of us that we're all as short-tempered and violent as they are. Since they don't even have to hate you to crack your skull right open. And they know we all hate them for what skull crackers they are all the time. They figure that we must all be coming for them all the time. That's why every time somebody calls 911, they show up like it's a raid in Fallujah. It's kind of out of control. But it's, you know, you let it go on for so long, and what happens? It's just like the torture. This becomes who we are. Right? How many years in a row can you go and go and go? How many little kids are growing up where their whole lifetime cops always dress like soldiers and carry assault rifles? That's what they call them when civilians own them, so I think it's appropriate. Before, this is just what America is. I mean, when I was a kid, cops were horrible, but they just wore button-up shirts. If they were the county sheriff, their shirt was brown. If they were the city police, their shirt was blue. But it was just a shirt. It was actually like an overgrown Cub Scout shirt. And they were total Nazi jerks. Right? They'll scream in your face like a drill sergeant. They might just throw you in the pink dungeon over the weekend for no reason. They're mean sons of bitches. But they weren't dressed up like an occupying army. Anyway, I'm off on the tangent, but... And I shouldn't make fun, because I am... It used to be... I used to be able to say, honestly and seriously, on my show... This is how long I've been doing it now, I guess. That this show is not really about me. It isn't about my problems. It's not about what I'm afraid of. It's just, geez, if they could do that to the Branch Davidians, maybe one day they could do this to us. Well, geez, if they could get away with this and they could get away with that, what do you think it's going to be like around here after the next six Patriot Acts? What do you think it's going to be like after all our sheriff's departments are full of all these battle-hardened war veterans? What do you think it's going to be like when the dollar's not worth a crap and you can't put food on your family and everybody's dependent on the state? But it's... It could happen if these things keep going out of control, but it's actually a new advent, I think, in my life that I'm concerned that, you know, and you know me, I got a hot temper myself, and not that I'm a violent person, but I get loud sometimes, and I admit that I'm a lot less willing. I do it anyway, but I try to check myself. You could probably tell. I'm a lot less willing to make fun of the cops. I mean, I'll still cover police abuse issues because I have to, because it's important, but I don't want to mock them and call them all sissy pants for dressing up in all that body armor, even though I do think that it's completely ridiculous. And I think they should know that we're all kind of secretly snickering at them when their backs are turned. But I really am hesitant to say that. And when I read some of these stories, you know, the ACLU, they have this montage of people saying, my boy, I can't believe that they would do him like this. I can't believe my son is in jail for selling a dime bag of weed for the rest of his life. Can't believe that they would do this. In fact, I should play that for you. Seems to me like when I hear stuff like that, maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe if I'm going to talk this bad about the police state, I should move to a different country. Maybe I shouldn't tell you. Maybe I should keep pretending to be in Austin, but I should move somewhere else. Where at least if they put me in prison, I'll be out in a little while. And I'm not a criminal. I'm not in violation of any law I can think of. But that apparently doesn't really matter. They can do what they want with you, and they can make up whatever lie about you that they want to. And you see this mother saying, my son is not a criminal. My son will give you the shirt off his back. My son is a good person. Oh, he was involved in a $20 drug sale, huh? Life in prison? If they could do that to him, they could do that to me. If they could do that to him, they could do that to any of us. And I don't know. I'm glad she mentioned Rand Paul on the mandatory minimum things, because that's the single best thing about Rand Paul in his whole life that he's ever done or said, is him, and I don't know how hard he's working on actually doing something about it, but it's important to have, never mind exactly who he is, it's just important to have a white Republican senator openly caring, and not in a pretend exploitative kind of way, but really caring about you know, how some in society treat those who are on the outs in the same society. You know? Hey, fellow golfers, maybe this neo-slavery, we could start winding it down, Rand said. Yeah, he was a bit more polite about it. But that's really important that he did that, and I'll praise him for that. And y'all know that I don't like Rand because he's such a disappointment for having the last name of the guy he's got the name of. But it's very important that he says that, and I really do hope that she's right, Jennifer Turner, that more and more this is going to be a political issue, a winning political issue, that... You know, hey, man, this is America. Do we really want to completely militarize everything? Every last sheriff's deputy running around with a machine gun? Isn't this a bit much? Isn't locking up every third black guy for at least 20 years for nothing during the prime of his life for no reason? Isn't that a bit much? I think maybe we could roll that back just a little, you know, for the sake of our own souls, so we don't become the kind of people who apologize for such things. Like, I had a guy the other day on my Facebook page taking Rand Paul's position that it would be perfectly fine if the FBI killed somebody with a drone, just as long as it's not the CIA or the military. And after all, you're just a Luddite if you deny that the future's coming where the government is going to have armed drones. So Rand Paul is right to be way out ahead of everybody else on DC in talking about times when, yeah, it'd be perfectly fine to use a drone to kill somebody if they were in the middle of a violent felony. Wow, really? Well, that's pretty narrowly defined circumstances, huh? And here's a guy who never would have said that in the world in a million years if it wasn't for the fact that that's what Rand Paul said. And so now he had to defend this horrible position. This is Rand Paul's idea of being good on drones. Well, Mr. President, I sure hope you don't think that you could use a CIA or a military drone against an American on American soil while they're just sitting in a cafe somewhere. But then again, you know, I mean, I'm saying, hey, if you had the FBI use one against someone while they were in the middle, and this was his example, and he used it in two different circumstances too, in the middle of robbing a liquor store, well, then I don't have a problem with that. Isn't that funny? Here he is staking out a good position. Yeah, 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 the world's a battlefield. I know you're not claiming to kill Alakis here in this country, even where you claim to the authority to kill Alakis American citizens overseas. Right, Mr. President? He just can't say that without mixing it with some horrible evil. That's how you know he's reasonable. But in this case, No one else in D.C. had yet proposed the FBI having drones to use them on liquor store robbers or anyone else. Violent criminals or anyone else. Rand Paul, trying to be reasonable and split the difference between his own perfectly reasonable already position that the president doesn't think he has the authority to use drones to murder Americans, does he? He's got to cut some middle ground, and so he cuts it in a way that makes him the worst on drones in America. Which means then so-called libertarians got to show up on my Facebook page to adopt his new position and defend it. And so now you have the spectacle of Ron Paul's son and some of his fans being the worst on this issue now, simply because that's what the cult of Rand demands, which I'd have thought somebody would have had to have had a little bit of charisma or personality or something to have a cult, but then again, who's a senator and who's a cranky, lowly old radio host? I just thought it was a legacy spot handed to him on a silver platter by his father's admirers who imagined that, well, of course, he'll take the very best parts of his father's program and carry it forward, right? Like getting out of Afghanistan and closing Guantanamo and stopping paying the Israelis to steal the West Bank and not sanctioning Iran and, Now the Paulians are the worst on the drones for domestic use issue? That's painful. But anyway, at least he's good somewhat. And you know what? Here's the thing. I may be quite wrong about this, right? Here I am praising Rand Paul for being good on the mandatory minimum thing. But for all I know, he built in a bunch of weasel words about, I'm all for prosecuting cocaine possession. I'm all for it, no matter how many Republican senators use coke every day. Oh, I'm all for prosecuting everybody for everything. Just not quite this badly, please. That's what I should assume he said. I don't know for sure, but I don't know why I should give him the benefit of the doubt. Whoops. I don't give him the benefit of the doubt. Long past giving him the benefit of the doubt. Well, I talked to him once back in 2009. And at that point, any benefit of the doubt was just gone. And I'll tell you the God's honest truth. I almost didn't post that interview. I almost covered up and buried that interview. Actually, I shouldn't say almost. I didn't almost. But we discussed it. There was a discussion. Man, I don't know. He was so horrible. Maybe we shouldn't post it. Maybe we should try to like get to him and teach him stuff and then, you know, give him another chance or something. What if we post this now and everybody decides it? What a horrible guy. I guess he is a horrible guy. I guess we have to post it so everybody will know. That was the end of my benefit of the doubt. Anyway, he could say, you know what's hilarious here? Rand Paul might actually be the best American senator ever. And he hadn't done anything as heroic as Gravel reading the Pentagon Papers into the record or Goldwater telling Richard Nixon, you better resign because I'm going to vote to convict you, you dirty SOB, or Frank Church, you know, holding the committee hearing on the CIA abuses, NSA abuses of the 70s. And I guess there were some senators who helped, you know, pass the anti-slavery amendment back in the day. There have been some good senators. Rand Paul might be one of the best senators in American history. He may be the best in a long, long time. But he's really bad on a lot of things, and he falls so far short of the standard that his father set that, to me, it's just a catastrophe. An unnecessary one, you know? There's no need to be bad on Iran's sanctions. That doesn't buy you anything. What, Bill Kristol loves you now? No. So you voted to starve some old grandmas to death. And what'd you get out of it? The right to claim that, yeah, I voted for the sanctions. Yeah, great. In fact, somebody on my Facebook page put it real well. All he's doing is alienating all the Ron Paulians who supported him or want to support him without gaining anything of it, not from the establishment that he's trying to suck up to. I mean, the average rank and file Republican voter, they'll go ahead and change their mind. They're okay. But that's not who he's trying to impress with all his, you know, warmongerism and half-libertarianism on so many issues. He's trying to impress Republicans with power, but they're not impressed. His name's still Paul to them. It's like it is to the Paul bots, who don't care how bad he is. But the truth is, he's really, he's got a lot of people who love his father have turned away from supporting him. I mean, he may well do fine with business interests in Kentucky and have a safe spot in the Senate, but he's certainly, I think, undermining his own case for an outsider. Frankly, it'd have to be a real outsider kind of a run for the presidential nomination next time, and I don't think he's going to do it. You know, what got Ron as far as he got was the love and devotion that people had for him, because they know that he's not going to sell him out. They know that if somebody sticks a mic in his face and asks him something important, he's going to get it right. So, you know, 99-something percent of the time, 95 or something percent of the time. But, yeah, I don't stand with Rand. I don't know who. I didn't even see Rand standing, actually. All right. What time is it? Man, I almost got to go. Coming up next, Michael Osterlink. Maybe he'll say some good things about Rand Paul, too. I don't know. Military spending is the subject. There's more of it than you know, I bet. More of it than any of us know. That's coming up. And, do you think she's going to take my message about guns back to the rest of the ACLU people? Hey, Scott Horton was saying if we were good on guns, that maybe people would like us better. Should consider that. Oh, I was going to say real quick, in fact, I'm glad I forgot to say it until the very end because I don't want to go on and on about it, about the JFK thing. I never said I believe Oswald did it himself. And in fact, even if Oswald was the lone gunman, that doesn't mean that whoever didn't put him up to it. I don't know for certain how many gunmen there were and whatever. It's not my favorite conspiracy theory. In fact, ever since I was a kid, I decided not to really try to master the subject because I figured there's so many different books pushing so many different angles that, meh, who even knows? I just figure, I kind of default on, it's like an agnosticism in a way. I default on, yeah, probably the military and or the CIA and or LBJ killed them, and some people think it was the mob, but eh, it's more likely the national security state. But that doesn't make him a good person. That doesn't mean he was good on anything. And it's especially hilarious to me to see right-wing conspiracy types who back then were the most likely suspects who thought he was a one-world communist on his side and claiming the New World Order killed him when he was Mr. New World Order then. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off.
no water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Next up is Michael Osterlenk. He's a transpartisan public policy consultant who works on issues such as transparency and anti-war stuff. Lots of anti-war stuff, anti-military spending. Here he is at the American Conservative Magazine, a huge archive at the American Conservative Magazine as well. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, great to be with you, Scott. It's been a long time. Nice to be back on your show.
Yeah, yeah, good to have you back. So, listen, I started off this path to getting you back on the show with this article by Denny Mertz from the Kalam Foundation, is that what it's called?
Kalam.
Right. And then, and it's the article is "Can the Pentagon Be Tamed?" And it's about what she calls an unlikely, but I like to think that it's more and more likely all the time, alliance of liberal and conservative groups determined to rein in Pentagon spending. And it's, you know, I don't know, maybe she's just a really optimistic writer or something like that, but it seems like there's some real progress to brag about.
There actually is. It's kind of a change of pace, and it's quite nice since the Tea Party came to power that we can actually now on the right, and I don't mean the libertarian right, because the libertarians have always been good on Pentagon spending, but on the conservative right, to start talking about the Pentagon and the billions of dollars that are wasted there, the fact that more money spent does not equal increased ability to defend ourselves. So it's a good time. Definitely so.
All right. Now, it seems like, the biggest success in military cuts would just be the sequester, right? So the Congress's gridlock and inability to agree how bad to rob us all has resulted in some automatic cuts across the board at the Pentagon. Is that right?
Exactly. The Budget Control Act, speaking of this coming fiscal year 2014, it caps spending at $498 billion, which is, you know, still quite high, but it's much better than the requested amount from the Obama administration, which is 550, and unfortunately McCain and Sessions in the Senate are requesting $524 billion. So if we can keep it at least at the BCA levels, we're cutting increasing growth, and if we keep it at 498, that'd be definitely a good start.
Boy, it's still a lot of money. And now
still a lot of money.
Yeah.
Definitely so.
Now
it's actually 2007 levels. So anyone who argues that we can't survive at 2007 levels when we're fighting two wars is delusional, mm-hmm. basically.
Well, and that's, I guess, I like to throw around the number a trillion a lot on the show, which I got three great sources for. On the left, Mother Jones Magazine, and from the Libertarians, Robert Higgs at the Independent Institute, and then the nonpartisan Chris Hellman at the National Priorities Project. They all say that total military spending is approximately $1 trillion a year, but that's not just the Pentagon budget. That's the war budgets, which I think are still kept separate. Maybe they changed that. I know Obama promised to change that. I don't know if they ever did. But then also that's the care and feeding of all the nukes and the Homeland Security State and all of that too, right?
Exactly right. I think it might be a little bit higher than $1 trillion, and that covers the whole national security state, not just the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And you're right; it includes overseas contingency operations, includes the nuclear the nuclear weapon systems, includes Homeland Security, et cetera, et cetera. And I think due to the leaks from Snowden, we now know that there's about $80 billion from the intelligence spent on the intelligence community.
Oh, right, because one of his leaks was the black budget, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So how much is $1 trillion?
$1 trillion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
How much is that?
$1 trillion?
Yeah, I mean, a million, a billion, a trillion, I don't know.
Well, do you remember on September 10th, 2001, then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld had a press conference where he declared war on the Pentagon budget, and this is just a day before 9/11, mm-hmm. and he said at the time that $2.3 trillion was unaccountable for. That is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and we increased military spending, and we lost the ability to even think about what the Pentagon is spending money on. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of disturbing, as you know, and you've talked about on your show for years now.
Well, did you see this new thing in the Reuters today?
What was that?
A special report. The Pentagon's doctored ledgers conceal epic waste. And I only got, it's a huge thing, I only got a fifth of the way through it or something. It begins with every month on Cook the Books Day, they make up a bunch of numbers to try to make the numbers make sense. And they do this once a month, and it's a lot of fun, and nobody gets in trouble. And, yeah, by the way, they don't even know how many hundreds of billions of dollars they can't account for. Which, I gotta ask you, where does it all go? I mean, when it comes to, like, black budgets and whatever, they already have as much money as they want, right? So, is this just, are there secret golf courses around that we don't know about, or what are they doing with all this money?
Well, let's even step back before we get into how they spend the money, because it's required by law.
The missing money is the stuff I'm talking about, you know? Because that's got to be getting funneled off to some purpose, right?
Yeah, but just in terms of an audit of the Pentagon, so we know where the money goes, it's required by law, 1992, that the DOD be audited by 1996, and it has missed every requirement since then to be audited. So, you know, you and I can have conversations, and we can bring in experts who know about particular programs that are wasteful, and there's tons of them and billions of dollars spent. But we actually don't know for sure where every penny goes. And you mentioned you know, golf courses and stuff. And a lot of our brass, you know, admirals and generals, do live quite high on the hog. I mean, nice buildings, nice complexes. They have their own chefs. They do have golf courses. I mean, and this is not the average everyday soldier, sailor, airman, marine. We're talking about the officers. So there is a lot of waste there, a lot of abuse. And as taxpayers, you know, it's just it's irresponsible. It's inappropriate. And I think it's criminal. To some degree or another.
Mm. You know what's funny too about this is the ratios. I remember, I guess this was maybe spring 2011 now. 2012 could have been. I think it was spring 2011. There was a report came out. Shocking numbers, everyone. Look, Lockheed spent $14 million on lobbying in just the first quarter of, again, I think it was 2011. And I thought, well, that's hilarious because, of course, they probably got $140 billion worth of profits in the contracts there. And this is the best racket in the history of the world if you can get in on it, right? I mean, yeah, whoever heard of an investment with such turnaround?
Yeah, except for the Federal Reserve, I think the defense spending is the biggest racket around. I would agree with you there. Unfortunately, we have quite a few groups within our coalition who do a good job of tracking some parts of these issues, which I would suggest some of your listeners go check out, if you don't mind me plugging some of our coalition partners.
By all means, go right ahead.
So National Taxpayers Union and R Street Institute put out a report about 6 months ago called Defending America, Defending Taxpayers. And it found $1.9 trillion in defense cuts possible over 10 years. So they went through all the weapon systems that either Congress didn't want, the Defense Department didn't want, that experts on the outside said were, you know, irresponsible to spend money on. $1.9 trillion worth that could be cut over 10 years. So that's an important report for your listeners to check out. Also would suggest to you to check out POGO, Project on Government Oversight. And they do a lot of research into what you just suggested in terms of Lockheed Martin and some of these other companies in terms of their contracts and things along those lines. So fortunately, there's a lot of groups out there on the right and the left, you know, libertarian, progressive, conservative, and liberal, who are doing their jobs trying to track these things down.
Right. Well, and, you know,
not an easy job.
I think someone who is clearly identifiable as a conservative, it packs so much more punch when they come out against military spending, just because the assumption is that, of course, they take every precaution for the national defense first before they would ever say such a thing. Whereas anyone on the left saying such a thing, the assumption is, oh, yeah, all you're saying is give peace a chance, but that's not an adult, you know, take on it. Or so when a conservative says, hey, we don't need this. We have to stop this. It's bad for the following six reasons or whatever. I think that, you know, makes an impression on, well, on the population, but also on the Congress and on the, you know, the pollsters, you know, the people with their finger in the wind trying to figure out what's what and who believes what. You could have just one person stand up and say, you know, I'm a conservative Christian businessman, and I say scale back the Pentagon. And I think that can really have a big effect. So I want to encourage people to do that. And I want to encourage liberals to embrace them instead of saying that, oh, no, you know, the conservatives are so bad on so many things, I don't want anything to do with them. How about, hey, look, even the conservatives are saying that we're right and that we've got to do this. So that really proves how smart we are, right? Give them some of that. And let's really do this. I think it's possible. It's not completely too late.
I think your analysis is right on, because liberals and progressives can only get so far, because they get blocked out by saying that you don't care about the, you know, national security and defense. And it's really, it does rely on the conservative voices to come out, who are seen, at least perceptually, as strong on defense, to be able to say exactly what you said, you know, enough is enough. Like, for instance, we work closely with Grover Norquist at Americans for Tax Reform, who's, you know, a fiscal hawk, and he came out, I think, about 2 years ago, commenting that the Pentagon needs to be looked at really closely, and there can be easily made cuts to the budget, and that every other program gets looked at. You know, it's funny, because conservatives will say money does not equal success. Why, you know, why put more money into education, Department of Education? You don't get more kids educated. More money into Health and Human Services doesn't make people more healthy. You know, that's kind of their argument. And Grover came out and said the same thing, and it's true with defense. Just because you spend more money on defense doesn't mean you have a better opportunity to defend yourself and more secure. And that was very helpful for us, because, you know, he's a big name on the right.
Right.
And there's others, too. You know, David Williams from the Taxpayer Protection Alliance has come out strongly in support of Pentagon spending reform. And I already mentioned NTU, the Republican Liberty Caucus, R Street Institute, Freedom Works. You know, a lot of these good groups on the right have really stood on the ground and said enough is enough.
Hey, and you know what? You know, with some names like that, you can get even better names, too. What about going to alliances of corporate, you know, businesses who are aligned on their export policies and approaching them? Because, and this, I don't mean weapons sales to foreign governments, but I mean in the civilian marketplace, because as we all know, the terror war has just killed brand America around the world. Jeans and sodas Nintendos, well, those are Japanese, whatever, you know, things. If Americans do make anything anymore, food, people are turning against it. I think in Iraq it was that they used to all drink Pepsi. That was the official, you know, no alcohol allowed. That was the official drink of Iraq. But after we bombed them for 20 years, now they all drink some cheap Egyptian knockoff and wouldn't be caught dead drinking an American soda. So that kind of stuff. I bet you could get, I mean, and that represents a lot of money to the people at Pepsi who don't care about anything else other than making money for Pepsi, because that's their job. So seems that, like you could, a, you know, try to recruit people like that, and then you got some real power behind you.
That's actually a great idea, and I think that's also a good idea in terms of, like, the NSA domestic spying. Because a lot of companies are now having difficulties in foreign markets, you know, the tech companies, because the foreigners are going to say, well, why should we buy Apple or Google or you know, Microsoft products when we know the NSA has snuck into the back of those products and can easily access what we're doing with those products. Yeah. So I think that's very true, what you're saying, in terms of just general American market power.
Right. I mean, hey, the business of America is business, but which businesses? The market ones, yeah, or Lockheed still gets whatever right. they want at the expense of everyone else.
You know, I would also suggest you might want to check this out, and this speaks exactly what you're just saying. There's a gal named Veronique DeRugi. She's an economist at the Mercatus Center. Mm-hmm. And about 6 months ago or so, she just released a report showing that every dollar that's pulled from the Department of Defense, the budget, adds about $1.30 to the market. So just in terms of, you know, increasing the growth of our own market here domestically, every dollar you pull out of the Defense Department increases $1.30 in the American marketplace.
Oh, that's great. That's exactly what we've been talking about on the show for the last few days. I asked Bob Murphy about that. You know, what if I could magically just abolish the entire national security state, the Pentagon and the Homeland Security and all the rest of it, all at once, and all those people were thrown out of work, and how bad of a dislocation it would be. And he talked about the unseen and all the great jobs and all the increased standard of living that would result, and how it would all be okay and in relatively short order and whatever. But now you're telling me there's a great study with some numbers I can cite, so I'm going to definitely have to look into that.
Yeah,
but of course that makes sense. Why should it be profitable to take a bunch of resources, put and labor and time, and mix it all together to make high explosives and then kill somebody and destroy some property with it? That doesn't sound like an economic positive for anyone.
No, definitely not. And you know, and keep in mind that we're not saying we don't want to get rid of the whole budget. We don't want to go down to zero. You know, we recognize, at least as part of our project, that we will have a standing army, we will have a Navy, we will have an Air Force, we will have the Marines, we will have Coast Guard, but we can spend a lot less and they could be that much more effective in what they do. And I think you and I would agree what they do needs to be discussed more clearly in terms of moving away from a kind of a neoconish foreign policy and being a little bit non-interventionist. That's my personal take. That's not necessarily the totality of the budget Pentagon budget campaign's take, but I think that would also save us a lot of money, too, if we weren't so invested in other countries' internal politics, militarily, that is.
You know, I'm sorry I don't remember who the author was, but I just read a thing the other day where they had compiled a bunch of block quotes from different military officials, I guess the Secretary of Defense and some other military officials, where the threat is, over and over again, as they put it, you know, if these sequester cuts go into effect, I won't be able to field an army on the other side of the planet at a moment's notice like you want me to all the time. And that's what they were all saying. None of them, I guess it hadn't occurred to them that a lot of us would be saying good, and that and that maybe if they really want the money, they should threaten that they won't be able to protect the homeland anymore or whatever their myth is that their job is. They weren't even bothering. They were just saying, listen, we're not going to be able to impose a world empire on this kind of budget. So you're kind of going to have to choose. And I sort of wonder whether they meant to say it that way quite deliberately, that maybe they don't want to field armies on such a moment's notice as often anymore. For now, anyway, maybe they want to come home, rebuild a little bit or whatever their interest is. But nobody's saying that poor America, the homeland between the homeland, the space between Canada and Mexico will all be under permanent threat from the dangerous rest of the world coming for us.
Right. Well, you know, you opened this conversation by talking about the opportunities we now have in terms of cutting Pentagon budget. But we have incredible opportunities now to reshape how we deal with the rest of the world. And it's a division within the Republican Party, and the debate that's taking place is great. And I'm hoping that the Justin Amash, Rand Paul, Senator Lee side, which encourages us to engage the world, you know, diplomatically and commercially and culturally and not militarily as much, wins out, and the kind of McCain side dies off. That's at least my hope.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is it's in times of crisis like this that the lines get a lot more clear about who's on whose side. And I think more and more, you know, this argument has much less to do with liberalism and conservatism among the people and which side they choose, as it has to do with the powerful versus everyone else. And people who, you know, typically are pretty hawkish are now over it and are, you know, okay, we had our fun for 13 years blowing stuff up, but now let's, you know, my mom's welfare is getting cut now, you know, my Medicare, my benefit is now under threat. It's time to go ahead and knock this off here. And it's only, you know, people like John McCain, who don't even represent their constituency, you know, their popular constituency whatsoever, but only the special interests, are the ones kind of sort of left standing out there in the wind by themselves, where we can all see them very plainly for who they are and what they represent. It's not the will of the American people. It's something else.
Very true. You know, and actually, would you mind if I gave the switchboard number to the Senate? Your listeners to call and call their senators, encourage them to keep the Budget Control Act numbers and not to go over sequestration numbers and get us more in debt.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, first of all, tell us specifically where they can read that so that they get it, you know, all their sound bites right when they call in.
Sure. I would suggest a few different places. You can, and I'm just going to give some places on the right. I'll give a couple on the right, a couple on the left, if you want to find, depending on your predilection, some information. So you can go to National Tax Treasurers Union. They have a blog post, an action alert on the Budget Control Act, which provides a lot of good information. FreedomWorks, same, as well as the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. And on the left, I'm thinking Win Without War might have something on their website, might be a good place to go. And you can also go to Pentagon Budget Campaign, the non-partisan website, which just has a lot of really good information. But what you want to do is call, and after you read all the information, call them, call your senators and say, you know, keep to the Budget Control Act number of $498 billion. You can even suggest you like it less, which I would encourage you to do. But don't let any of the senators go above it and get us even more into debt and increase our deficit. And the number is 202-224-3121. And that's the Congressional Switchboard. And all you got to do is ask for your particular senator. And that'd be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, now talk a little bit about how helpful it'll be, because, you know, senators, they're a bunch of senators. What do they care about what we say to them?
Well, you know, it's funny because yes and no, they do care and they don't care. So I've had conversations with a member of Congress and they'll say, all we need is 10 phone calls and we'll pay attention on an issue. And if they get a lot more, then they pay that much more attention. Now, there are some issues for ideological reasons or for political reasons, or they're not going to give a crap how many calls they get. But there are enough members in the House and the Senate who care enough just for political reasons, because they want their constituents to be happy, that 10, 15, 20 phone calls on a particular issue will move them. Like I said, it doesn't move everyone on all issues, but it will help for sure.
Yeah, it just kind of changes the atmosphere a little bit, the background to their discussions. Well, you know, the exactly. People have been calling in saying this and that. However much weight they give that, it sort of means something, right?
No, it really does. It really does.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now, I'm sorry, this is sort of belongs back at the beginning of the interview, but could you give us some examples of the kinds of stuff where they're just throwing money away in ways that people wouldn't believe, except it really is true? Because, you know, we hear about the $900 hammer or whatever, but that was a long time ago.
Sure. So there's Abrams A1. It's a tank. And the Department of Defense actually does not want it because all it does is sit in the desert. I think in Nevada there's a place that they sit there. And I think they're spending about $3 billion on either new ones or revamping the old ones. And the Department of Defense doesn't want it because they're not going to be used. My understanding is that it keeps getting funded because at least one of the production facilities is in Ohio, where Representative Boehner, you know, head of this and the House side, resides. So for, it's at least that piece of it is very political, why they keep funding it. Another project, which is tens of billions of dollars, and it's going to be hundreds of billion dollars when it's done, when it's all said and done, is the F-35, which is a combat aircraft that has been proven mostly ineffective, high cost overruns, and a lot of people are just saying it's, you know, it's just a waste of our money, and they'd rather go back to the older versions of aircraft that have proved effective in combat, including in combat more recently in Afghanistan and Iraq. But unfortunately, we're moving forward with the F-35. So if any of your listeners want to, you know, there's actually a side effort as part of the effort. I'm part of the transpartisan effort that is focusing in on, you know, reforming the F-35. Some people want to get rid of it. I would go that far, just get rid of it, because I think it's just a complete waste of money. But that's another example of tens of billions, and soon enough be hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayers' money is flushed down the toilet.
Well, and then didn't they announce that they were quitting making the F-22? Because at least the F-22 can drop a bomb on the ground. The F-22 can't even shoot at the ground. So, but then they announced that, no, we're going to keep making them anyway.
The F-22 I'm not so familiar with. What I can speak to is that the F-35 is supposed to replace the A-10. And I'm actually heading to a conference on Friday on the A-10. The Air Force wants to get rid of them. But the guys on the ground, especially in Afghanistan, have been very pleased with the A-10 because it can fly really slow and drop a lot of ordnance. And it's been very helpful for close quarters you know, protecting our guys who are under a threat by the Taliban, where the F-35 cannot do that kind of combat mission. Right. So I can't speak to the F-22, but I can say that there are other aircraft that would better replace the F-35 that we already have. So we don't even have to go, you know, the only thing you might have to do is update them, which is a lot less expensive than creating a whole new aircraft.
Right. And, you know, I got this one here just to finish up here. We're almost out of time for the show, but I just thought this one was hilarious. From Fox News on October the 7th, new Air Force cargo planes fly straight into mothballs. And these C-27Js are flying out of Italy, landing in Arizona, and going straight to the boneyard at a cost of $50 million each. All right, good times. Thanks again for your time. Michael Osterlenk, everybody.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate
it. And check him out at the American Conservative Magazine. And check out this great piece, Can the Pentagon Be Tamed? At opendemocracy.net. They got links to all the different groups he was mentioning for you there. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you tomorrow.